Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to another edition we have here of Suspense Radio Inside Edition. This is April 2nd, 2016. We want to thank you all, however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show. It's always great to have you with us. Today we got 60 minutes of Suspense Radio, two fantastic authors. We're going to kick it off with author David Putnam, and then we are going to welcome back author Elizabeth Heider. So, again, we want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to us on iTunes. That's always probably the best way to get all the latest shows right into any listening device, however you listen to podcasts or radio shows. You can throw it right in there, and as soon as it's done, you'll get it. That's Crime and Science Radio, The Story Blender, Beyond the Cover, Inside Edition, and One-on-One, all five shows here on the network. All of our shows are, of course, brought to you by Kensington Books. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on their authors and their new releases, which include Kevin O'Brien, Lisa Jackson, two of my favorite authors, and also Revell Books and Baker Publishing, so make sure you check them out. We are going to now jump into our first guest. His latest book is called The Squandered. It is the third book in his Bruno Johnson thriller series. So we are very pleased to welcome to the first time here to Suspense Radio, David Putnam. So David, thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me. This is great.
And you know, we kind of talked a little bit off the air. You know, we kind of came a little bit roundabout way from a mutual friend that used to work at a publisher, and now he's kind of out on his own and doing his thing. So it's great to be able to kind of expand the community and get new authors on and be able to speak to you for the first time and about your series. And, of course, you know, your latest book, which came out called The Squandered, it is the third in your series. So why don't we just jump right in here and you just kind of let us know what is going on here in your Bruno Johnson thriller series?
Like you said, this is the third book in a series, and it's a little bit hard to describe unless I start from the beginning. Disposables is set in South Central Los Angeles, and that's the first book in a series with Bruno Johnson. He is an ex-con. He's gone to prison. When the book opens, he's working at a liquor store, and the story is about how Bruno rescues children from toxic homes in South Central Los Angeles, children that the social services people have let down. So he rescues the children, and then he escapes to Costa Rica. The third book opens in Costa Rica, and there's a note from his brother who's in prison, and his brother has children that he had while he's in prison, and his children are in jeopardy. So Bruno's father asks Bruno to go back and to California and help his brother who's in prison. And that's basically the essence of book three.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we get so let's get a little bit more here involved with the series, and let's kind of go back. And I guess, like you said, we'll kind of go back and we'll kind of start at the beginning with, you know, the disposables and the replacements. So when fans pick up the first book and they kind of get involved with it and then they get in and then they kind of go through, what's the ride that you're kind of taking them on through the first book and now into The Squandered?
I worked 31 years in law enforcement, and I worked actually in South Central Los Angeles, and I'm basing the character as a detective who used to work on a violent crimes team, which is what I used to do. I used to chase murder suspects and follow bank robbers and that kind of thing. So he uses his experience to help the children outside the law, where he couldn't help them when he was working within the law. The background of the story is Bruno had a daughter, and she died of an overdose, and her spouse had abused the child, one of his twin grandsons, to death. And Bruno chases him down while he's on a violent crimes task force and shoots and kills him. And so Bruno goes to prison for that. And the book opens with him trying to rectify in his mind going outside the law to do that and at the same time save the children.
So I guess, you know, when fans pick up, you know, they always kind of like to know who, you know, the main character is. Like, if they were to sit down and maybe have a beer with them and talk to them and this and that, give us, you know, the story of who exactly is Bruno Johnson. You know, what kind of person is he? You know, how would he handle certain situations, you know, that maybe he hasn't encountered yet or he has encountered? You know, to give fans a little bit of insight into who the man is.
Bruno Johnson, I I've been writing for 22 years. I've written 45 manuscripts. I was on manuscript number 38 when I sold number 34, which was the disposables. So I was trying a bunch of different things to try to get published, and I decided to go with a different structure. I went with a thriller structure rather than a traditional mystery structure. And I also shifted to a black African-American character to give it more conflict. And when I went to South Central Los Angeles, the Linwood stations where I worked, I went out with 10 deputies, and it was an all-white station, and they were trying to integrate it with black deputies. And I went out with another deputy who was black, and he was a good friend of mine, and we got really close while we were working there. But I saw how he had to put up not only with the hazing of the deputies and the problems on the street, but the third conflict was him being black and having to put up with the prejudice of the people at the station. So I wanted to show that, what I experienced. And so Bruno has to deal with that as well. And he has a big heart because he tries to rescue the children. But if you cross him, he can turn very violent very quickly. And that's what I was trying to come across with.
And you said that you kind of had to change gears a little bit because you wrote so many manuscripts, and so you decided to kind of change gears. Now, what was the thought process behind, you know, I understand, you know, maybe you felt like you had to kind of go in a little different direction, but again, you know, why did you kind of go in that direction, and why did you feel that it was going to kind of work for you?
What I was going with, what was popular, was being sold the most, and that was the I was writing a like a 11 to 12 page chapter, and I would have an odd number of scenes in it, 3, 5, or 7 scenes in it, and that's what was normal for like the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and then starting in the 90s they started going to one scene chapters, and so I shifted my structure to the one scene chapter, and then I started getting a lot more play from New York out of it. And then the problem with the one scene chapter is you have to be very cognizant of your transition and your hook at the end of the chapter so it's seamless. And that was the shift that I made. Bruno Johnson, I like Bruno Johnson. The voice, I think, is what carries the book. He's very caring and knowledgeable about the street. And I don't know what else I can say about him.
Well, you had to have, you know, you're still discovering him because, you know, you are into book 3, and of course, I have to imagine that, you know, you're going to be 4, 5, 6, and you have ideas about how things are going to progress into the future. But how have things kind of changed from the disposables, replacements, and, you know, now into the squandered that may have even surprised you and gone into maybe a different direction that, you know, when you started writing and you started figuring everything out, that this is kind of a little bit of a change from maybe what you thought you were going to do and maybe what fans are going to notice in the squandered maybe from the first two books?
Yeah, everybody has said that book 2 was better than book 1 and book 3 was better than book 2. And the publisher just purchased the fourth book, and it comes out in February, a year from now. And I'm deep into writing the fifth book as well. And what I found that motivation is a big factor for me and for readers. And so I go back and do a lot of background story in book two and book three. No, book three and book four. And so the first third of the book is set like 20 years before, and it shows why Bruno is involved in the caper in current day. So it shows the challenge to that was to show Bruno as a young Bruno and being naive and inexperienced, and then come back to current day and have him knowledgeable and knowing what's going on and very sure of himself.
And you have 31 years of law enforcement experience, like you said. You know, if people don't understand Southern California, Linwood is not a really good area. You know, I remember having to go to a hospital in Linwood for something that I was doing at one time, and they said
Saint
that
Francis.
They called it a safe zone. I had never heard the term safe zone before, Grover Living. They're like, no, the hospital is a safe zone. There's this area, you know, the gangs won't come because this and that. And I go, okay, you got to explain that. So how are you able to kind of take those, you know, your experience and put these things within the book, and how much of the stuff in there is actually maybe real that people might think are fictionalized?
There are, in the first book, there are five incidents that actually happened, and I fictionalized them, but they're written very close to what happened. And then in book two, the inciting incident is something that actually happened to me. And then I try to blend in throughout the book incidents that I was involved in, officer-involved shootings, foot pursuits, vehicle chases, you know, that kind of thing.
Can you give us a hint of one of the five in the first book that was real that you kind of have in there?
There's in book two opens. It's called The House That Bled, the scene is, and it's referred to that throughout the book. And Bruno goes to what I called a child hostage exchange, where the parents can't get along, and they're doing a divorce, child custody exchange.
Oh.
And he gets there, and the father's knocking on the door, and the ex-wife won't answer the door. Bruno thinks there's just something wrong, so he goes outside of policy, and he kicks the door in. And water floods out of the house. There's about 4 inches of water, and he goes inside, and there's all the drains and faucets, all the drains of the kitchen, the bathroom, all the water's running. The drains are blocked, and he's got all the faucets running, and it's been running for a while. And there's little rivulets of blood on top of the water running throughout the house. And he finds the wife shot in the chest on the couch, with a gun in her hand, and the three children in the other rooms are shot as well, except for one is still alive, and Bruno rescues him. And then book two, that's the backstory, the incident, the inciting incident. And then fast forward 25 years later, and the kid that Bruno rescues is gone psychotic and wants to get revenge on Bruno, and he kidnaps some kids. And that's the essence of the story of book two, and that's how The House That Bled actually happened to me when I was a very, very young patrol officer, and it made a very big impression upon me. So it was a very emotional scene. I tried to put that emotion into the story.
Yeah, that was actually going to be the next question, because, I mean, I'm sitting here, and just in the minute that you told that story, I couldn't fathom walking into a scene like that and seeing that, and then being able to take all those emotions that you had, and, you know, whether it was, maybe 20 years ago, and then having to bring all of that back up and writing that down, capturing that emotion so that reader can almost have that goosebump-like experience with you as they're reading that. So how was that dynamic? I mean, what was the difficulty maybe in transitioning how you felt, putting it down to have other people kind of have that same experience when they read that part of the book?
Well, that story in particular was one of the more difficult experiences, and I kept it locked away for a long time. I rarely told anybody about that. So when I did write about it, it was kind of tough. But once I started it, it all came out in a flood, and I think I captured it pretty well. So I tried to do other scenes similar to that. I was in some wild shootouts, and I try to put those in there as well, just as the way they happened.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that, of course, whenever you hear ex-law enforcement people, whenever they turn author and whenever they start putting their stories down, you always hear a lot of that emotion. And when you're creating that character, Bruno Johnson, of course, you're taking from a lot of different places and a lot of different emotions. So when creating a character like Bruno Johnson and all the things that you've had to go through and now he has to kind of experience too, how is that creation process working for you as you go along in the books and especially now into The Squandered?
The creation, I have no
problem.
I never
thought it
was going to
be
that
easy.
Like I said, I was on number 38 when I sold number 34, and it was a one-off. It was the disposal was a standalone, and when the publisher picked it up, I knew that they would probably want a series. So I stopped on number 38. I backed up and I started writing the sequel, which was the Replacements. And at the time, I had no idea what I was going to write. So I just went back, like I said, to the most emotional thing that I'd ever been involved in and said, use that as an inciting incident. The difficulty was, after that, linking the story to that incident.
And now I also want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author David Putnam, and you can go to dwputnam.wordpress.com for more information on all of your books, and you can kind of catch up on events and things you know that you're doing. So it's a difficult situation also for authors to have to kind of put themselves out there because, you know, you're always – you know, it's – authoring is a different thing. It's a very it's very much alone, and you know, you're always by yourself at your computer. You don't have a bunch of people around you or whatever while you're doing things. So now that you're kind of out talking about the books and you have to kind of get yourself out there, how difficult was that for you? You know, was that maybe that process? Or maybe it wasn't because you were always kind of in with the public and you always dealt with a lot of people. But now this is the first time that you really have to kind of market yourself as a person and your work.
I don't do well with the marketing part because I don't like talking. I don't like talking to people. I mean, in a group, I could talk. You know, in an incident, I have no problem walking up and taking control of an incident. But I kind of freeze up. I used to, but now I'm doing much better because this is our third year now. I think we've been going to different talks, and I have this talk that's called "The Anatomy of Violence and What It Takes to Shoot Somebody," and it's gotten a lot of great reviews, and people, every time I give it, somebody walks up and asks me to give it someplace else. And it's the there's three things that I think you need for an officer involved shooting: the legal right, the moral right, and the emotional ability to pull the trigger. And a lot of the public doesn't understand that, so I try to bring that across in my books as well. And in the talk, I give the violent confrontations I was involved in leading up to my first officer-involved shooting. And I go through each one of those three things and explain at each incident why I didn't shoot. And then on the last one where I did have to shoot.
And, of course, you know, that is a tremendous hot button in society right now. So, you know, your books are kind of dealing with what is going on in today's society. And I don't know if you had thought that that's what was going to happen. Of course, you know, it's very difficult to foretell these kinds of events. But just maybe from your side of everything, and you kind of see how society is reacting to officer-involved shootings, do you maybe plan on putting some of that controversy even further and into a deeper sense into your books as you go on into the series?
Yeah, I do, and I don't use it as a hammer. I try to do it subtly. But what people don't realize today, what's going on, in my opinion, after 31 years of experience, I'm analyzing the different officer-involved shootings, is the officers have the first one, the legal right to shoot, but they don't have the moral right. And that's what's causing all the controversy. And that's why the officers, it looks to the public like, oh, they shouldn't have shot like that. They shouldn't have shot that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then
right.
it goes to court, the district attorney reviews it, and he puts all the factors in, and he realizes that it's legal, not necessarily moral, and the cop walks away from it. So if the cop would just take an extra second and have that second moral right, there wouldn't be as many problems going on today as there is.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, of course, all you hear from the media is what you hear from the media. And, of course, you never really hear the both sides. You always just hear the side that's going to make the most news coverage and the most, the biggest splash, I guess you want to say. But how much of police work, and, you know, it's good to have you on also to kind of talk about, because how much of police work is just maybe what percentage is just normal routine, going kind of through the motions. And, you know, when you're writing a character like that, of course, you always have to have the thrills and the chills that goes into the book. But there's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of downtime being a police officer, I would think.
Well, I only worked patrol a short time at the different agencies that I went to, and then I was put on special teams. So I actually went after the most dangerous people. So my downtime was not as much as a guy working patrol all the time. And you're right, it's probably 95% report taking and communicating with the public. The biggest thing is communicating with the public. I was an avid reader all my life. I mean, I read everything. I wasn't necessarily a writer, and I was on a stakeout in Lucerne Valley, which is in the middle of Mojave Desert, and I kept novels in the back seat of my car. And when downtime on chasing somebody like that is you have the eye, one guy watching the house, and everybody else is laid off. You have five cars laid off. And those laid-off cars can do whatever they want, just as long as they have the radio on. So I read a lot of books that way while working. And that particular day, I had one book left. I picked it up. It was a national bestseller. I started reading it, and it was just horrible. I mean, I couldn't believe how bad this book was. So I had to read the whole thing. I was a captive audience. I had nothing else to read, so I read the whole book. And I thought, you know, I could do better than this. So I started penning my first I wrote my first four novels on four legal pads each while sitting in a cop car doing surveillances or, you know, waiting for something to happen. And then I had them transferred to disk, and then eventually self-taught myself how to type.
That is awesome. That is amazing. I mean, and, you know, and it is funny. Sometimes you do read what they consider bestsellers, and you're like, how did this ever get published? And why is it even popular? I think the same thing about a lot of authors that are extremely, you know, successful, if you want to say, but, boy, the writing just really isn't there. So, yeah, I feel for you on that one. I know about all that one. So,
well,
now, go ahead.
What happens a lot is a writer will work on one book for 10 years, and then he'll get it published, and then he has 1 year to write that next book. He doesn't have that 10 years to polish it. So I call the second book drag, and that's what happened on this. This was this guy's second book, and his first book was really fantastic. But the second book just, was bad news.
Yeah, I mean, and you hear from, and I always kind of use music, too, because a lot of musicians, it's like, well, you had your whole life to create that first album. You're on a deadline for album number two. So it's like sometimes the debut is really good, and then they kind of fall flat because you're right. You don't have unlimited time to now create the second one. You're put under contract, and you're put on deadlines.
Right. And because I wrote 45 manuscripts, I can write relatively fast and know whether it's working or not.
Now, real quick here, too, I also want to know what kind of character in the book here, and we're talking The Squandered, had a bigger voice than you originally might have thought they were going to on the onset when you kind of first started out maybe plotting it down, and then all of a sudden they just kind of leaped off the page and you're like, you know, you didn't realize that the secondary character was going to be, you know, such a big part of the story.
That happened more in book two, Replacements. I was trying to write an antagonist, and it was I named him Carl Drago. And I took him right from a guy that I was chasing. He was a two-time murder suspect who was let out on parole, and they put my team on him to follow him around so he wouldn't kill somebody else. And he was very, very bad. So when you write a character, it's just like writing a protagonist. You can't make him all good because he looks cardboard. He looks fake, so you got to give him some flaws. So when you write an antagonist, when you give the antagonist flaws, you have to give him some humanity. So what happened with Carl Drago, I gave him some humanity, and it started taking off, and I ended up redeeming him to the point where I couldn't kill him off or put him in jail at the end because he was too good. But he was the most dastardly and heinous guy in the book. And everybody that reads it, they talk about Marie and Carl Drago almost more than they talk about Bruno because of the way Drago turned out.
Oh, and you know, and that's, and I think that exploring yourself like that really tends to, you know, making better books. And I'm not saying that it took you 34 books to kind of figure out how you're going to do it, but I think that you continually to learn as you keep writing, and these surprises keep happening.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I agree.
So we got about a minute or so left, and what I want to kind of do is I would like to kind of give you the last word. You can kind of let everybody know, you know, your social media, all the places to maybe find you and find more information. So I will leave that up to you.
You can find me at davidputnambooks.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook, an author page on Facebook. That's about it.
Yeah. Are you pretty active on the social media stuff?
I'm old school.
I'm not.
And I'm
not
on
a
there,
big social media man. I just can't handle it. Too much.
I put some Twitter out that's linked to my Facebook, so you'll see me pop up. Probably once every other day or so, I put something out that I see on the news or something strikes my fancy. I put it out so people could see my train of thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one thing that I always try to that I don't let it do is, and I don't know, and I see some authors I think doing this, is they let social media kind of dictate how they're going to write their next book because they kind of see how the audience reaction is to certain things or whatnot, and then they kind of lose themselves a little bit. So I try to stay off social media. I really don't care what Aunt Millie is having for lunch. That's just not my thing.
Yeah.
But boy, people sure like to tell everybody everything, though.
And my wife and I go to a lot of conferences.
Yeah.
go to a lot of conferences, and I've had several people come up to me and said, "Oh, I thought you were black because I was writing a black protagonist."
And you're like, "Nope, surprise!" But read the book anyway. So yeah. All right, David. Hey, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. I wish you nothing but the best. Enjoy. Have a lot of fun. Congratulations on the next book, Contracted. And can't wait to see what you have coming in the future. So thank you for coming on again.
Thank you very much. This has been great.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author David Putnam. And the book is called The Squandered. It's book 3 in his Bruno Johnson thriller series. Again, you can go to davidputnambooks.com. For more information, or dwputnam.wordpress.com. He also has that site, and you can find out more information. We're going to take a short break, and then we are going to be back here with our next guest. She's back again here, Elizabeth Heiter, for the next book in her book. It's her book 3. It's called Seized, and we are going to be speaking to her about that. So in the meantime, take a quick listen, and we'll talk with you soon. Everybody here after the break. Again, we want to thank you all for listening however, wherever, whenever you listen to the show. The easiest way, of course, is to just subscribe to us on iTunes. Just search Suspense Radio and you'll see us, and then you can just say subscribe and then you're done. See how easy that is? Some things are difficult, some things are easy, and that's an easy thing. So we want to welcome back to the show again. We had her on and we're trying to figure out, I think it was about maybe 6 to 8 months ago, that we had her on with her the second book that had come out in her series, and that was called Vanished. We had met her in BoucherCon in Long Beach a little over a year ago when that was going on, and we're so happy that we're able to see and see the progression of her series coming on, because now she's in book three, and it's called Seized. So we want to welcome back to the show Elizabeth Heider. So, Elizabeth, thanks for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, absolutely. You know, your series is called the Profiler series, and it started off with The Hunted, and then we moved to Vanished, and now we're into Seized. So why don't you kind of give everybody a little bit about the book Seized, and we'll talk about the series in general for people that are just finding out about you.
Sure. So the Profiler series follows FBI profiler Evelyn Bain. She's the youngest agent in the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, and I created her having had her freshman abduction when she was 12, and that kind of led her into the FBI. And so fast forward 18 or so years later, and during Steve, my character is kind of in some trouble with her boss because she's done some things in during the course of Vanish, the previous book, that he's mad at her about. And so he's sending her on these BS assignments. He sends her to Montana to interview a convicted bomber in prison. And while she's there, another agent approaches her and says, there's a group out in the wilderness in Montana that the BAU, Behavioral Analysis Unit of the FBI, has tagged as a cult, but I think they're a bigger threat, and I want to provide a profile. And everyone's kind of thinking, well, this could be my chance to see if I really still belong here, and prove to my boss that I belong here. So she goes with this agent, and when they get to the group, it turns out the other agent is right, because they're taken hostage, and Evelyn realized that there is a threat here. She needs to get the information to the FBI. The only way she can do that is if the FBI breaches the compound, but if they do breach the compound, then she's going to be the first casualty.
Mm-hmm. And that's not a very fun thing to put her in, so that wasn't very nice of you to put her in that situation. But she needs to kind of be, because book three in a series, it's just like we just had David on, book three in a series is kind of like the explosion part, because you're kind of introducing people into The Hunted, and then things kind of change a little bit, like with Vanished, and now you're in Seized, and now it's like the explosion. Now it's kind of like, okay, we're kind of like, boom, here we go, and then it's kind of run away from this point. Did you, first of all, I guess you got to kind of figure out, when you have an FBI character, they can go all over the country. So you have a lot of places to choose from. So I guess the first question is, when in Hunted, you kind of had her in Virginia, and then you kind of moved her out of that from Vanished. Now she's into Montana because you went from, Virginia to South Carolina. Now you took the East Coast all the way down to the upper Northwest. Why there? What was the intrigue? What was the pull to kind of explore that area?
When I started doing the research for the book, I knew I wanted to do something with a cult, and that's kind of where it started. And then I started doing the research, and as I got into it, I found more and more similarities between cults and terrorism. And I thought, I'm going to do a twist on this, and this cult is not going to be quite what it seems. There's going to be a possible terrorist threat here. And so I started doing research on terrorist groups, and I started doing research on survivalists as well. And I discovered that the remote area of Montana, it's actually where the Unabomber had a cabin, was a great place to set a group of people that didn't want the world to know they were there. And so I set them out there kind of in the wilderness where they're initially they're leaving everyone around alone. They're not causing any problems, and people don't really think anything of the fact that they're out there up in the mountains in the wilderness because it's very sparsely populated. And I just, that's part of the reason I wanted to write an FBI character, and a profile in particular is because I could send her wherever I wanted to around the country, and it would just be fun to put her in new places. So in this book, she actually traveled quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, the good thing about cults are you can do a lot of fun things when you write about a cult. So
yeah,
what was it, when you said you wanted to kind of explore them, what was the pull for you to explore them?
You know, at this point with my character, because, you know, you get into a series sometimes and you can fall into that thing where your character doesn't really have any more places to grow. And I didn't really want to have that happen with my character. And after Vanished, she solved the case that she joined the FBI to solve. And so in Seized, I have her a little bit lost, like trying to really refigure out her identity, who she is. And I thought, what better plot to pair that up with than something to do with a cult where it's all about kind of reshaping people's identities and brainwashing them. So that's part of what initially sent me into the cult. And then sometimes in the process of doing research, I discover my plot.
Mm-hmm. And how is that process when you kind of had the idea that you wanted to do this, then you kind of start getting involved with it, but now you got to have to cultivate the characters and kind of the things around it. So what was that process like? How was that pull? Because, you know, you're getting involved in something that you can only really read about. It's kind of, you know, you can go and you can explore it if you want to. But that's kind of a dark place you're taking yourself, right?
It is. I mean, I really enjoy the research, but some of it is very dark. And for me, it started kind of with that idea of, okay, I want to explore cults, and that led me into kind of looking into terrorism and doing research on survivalists and pulling it all together for the plot. But because I write a profiler, my character has to figure out the psychology of why people do things. And so that was kind of my next step. Okay, who's my villain and why is he doing it? And then from that, the plot just kind of comes naturally, the twists and the turns. And this book, there's quite a few twists and turns that happen. There's a big one pretty early on.
Yeah, and isn't it funny when you start getting into the psyche of people that when you start exploring that and then you start having your character, Evelyn, explore those things, that you almost end up with more questions than you do answers.
Sometimes, yeah. And it's I like to have my characters, you know, have shades of gray, really, where every villain I've created has something good about them, something redeemable, even though, you know, my first book dealt with a serial killer, so obviously you don't want him to win. But hopefully on some level you identify with something about him, because most people are just not as simple as pure evil and absolute hero. The more you dig into it, the more like shades of gray you find and the more places you realize you can develop a character and different ways you can do that. So that was, I love the process of the research and creating the characters before you dive into the book.
Yeah, because, you know, because you're absolutely right. I mean, there's not a lot of characters. I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, villains out there that are just so batshit crazy that they just do things because they're just so crazy. You know, there's always a pull of why they're kind of doing the things that they're doing. And that's the creation of the character that you kind of have to get yourself involved in. What did you kind of find out when you were creating the characters here for Seized and the kind of the story that kind of surprised you kind of maybe going along the way as you were writing the book?
I think along the way, I actually, one of the secondary characters in the story, as I was creating her, she's the character who led Evelyn into the compound and kind of said, was really insistent, like, there's a threat here and nobody else saw it. And she was convinced there was a problem and she wasn't going to be the agent who missed it. That character really surprised me how she developed and what ended up happening with her as I created her, because she was one of the few characters. Usually when I start, I have a pretty good sense of who the characters are and kind of how they're going to end up in the story. But she really surprised me as I created the story. I added in some things I hadn't expected to do, and I won't give too much away because they happen later in the book, but there were a lot of twists and turns with her character that I realized as I wrote, so then I kind of had to go back through and make that fit.
So you can kind of say that when people start reading it and as they start going along, sometimes things are not always what they seem is what you end up having at the end.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, for fans, I guess, that have been following you now through The Hunted and now, you know, into Vanished and then now going into Seized, what was one of the one thing that maybe you felt that they will see that might be different in your writing style? Because, you know, authors, you know, you progress in your writing style and you change a little bit and you kind of, you know, grow. How have you grown from the beginning of the series and now through Seized?
You know, one of my goals as a writer has always been to make every book that I'm writing the best possible book I can write at the time. And it's true that I think the more you write, hopefully the more practice you get, the better you get. And so I think that my writing style has changed over the course of the book. I think the third book, there's probably a lot more twists and turns in the plot, a lot more action, and a lot more, I think the characters have gotten more complex, too, as I go. And I'm getting more and more interested in the kind of exploring those shades of complexity within the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interesting to hear that from readers, though, you know, what their perspective is on how I've changed from Hunted to Seized.
You know, and when you talk about readers and social media and everything being so instant, I mean, you're able to, you know, as soon as the book is out that day or the day after, and, you know, you even have some early reviews, you start to see things that are just heinous and things are start coming right out where, you know, pre-internet, you couldn't really have any of that. You just kind of had to wait and see and maybe get an idea. What are the things that maybe readers and fans are kind of telling you, and, you know, how many of them are surprises? Like, wow, I can't believe that they're really focusing on that part.
You know, I think one of the things that I heard early and often from readers with this series was that they loved the character of Kyle McKenzie, who's a hostage rescue team agent with the FBI, who kind of in Hunted, you know, has a romantic interest in Evelyn, and he has a role. And as the series progresses, his role gets bigger and bigger. He actually becomes more and more of a main character. And I was happy about that because I love writing him. But I was, I guess, kind of surprised how instantly people latched onto him and wanted to see more of him right from the start. So that was kind of cool. And then I think in this one, it's been really interesting to see people's reaction to the character of Rolf, who is one of the characters in the cult. He's the basically lieutenant, the second in charge, and to see kind of what people think of him, because right from the beginning, he's actually in some ways an ally to Evelyn inside the cult. He's keeping her alive, but at the same time, you don't really know what ulterior motives he might have for doing that, or why he's helping her when he's second in command and he should not like her. So it's been really interesting to see what people thought of him and what they thought of him like when they started the book and when they finished the book.
Now, the other thing, and I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with the with author Elizabeth Heiter, and you can go to Elizabeth, and it's ElizabethHeiter.com for more information on the books. The other thing that you did with this book, Seized, and you kind of did it like right before it came out, was there was a short story called Avenged, and this, and the kind of the byline is Love and Vengeance. So tell us about, you know, the short story. Was this a bridge from Vanished into Seized? Is it something totally different? Where did this kind of story come about with the series?
You know, this is kind of cool because I hadn't planned to write a short story, but my publisher came to me and said, what do you think about writing a short story? We'll put it up for free, and, you know, it'll be 10,000 words compared to the 100,000 words of the book, and just have it be set. You know, they didn't tell me when I had to set it or what I had to do with it, just that they wanted to have my main character, Evelyn, and the character of Kyle play a role. And so I thought, okay, well, the perfect time to set it is in between the time when Vanished ends and when Seized begins, because Vanished really changes Evelyn's life in some major ways, and her relationship with Kyle changes in that book. So I thought, okay, well, I'll put the story in between. And you don't have to read it for Seized to make sense or anything, but there is a little snippet in Avenged that I put in that comes back in Seized, and so people who have read both will see the connection there. And it's funny because I put it in Seized. It's a reference to something that happened to her while she was on vacation that she's using essentially as a code word before I wrote Avenged. And then when they asked me to write Avenged, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to actually show that scene. So that was kind of fun.
And when you decided that you were going to kind of do this, and you kind of had to maybe, like you said, you maybe had to do this a little on the fly, you really didn't have anything kind of down. And, of course, with e-books being able to do this really fast, do you think that this is something that maybe you're going to do in the future as more of a planned event? So maybe have something at the end of a book where maybe it's maybe like a cliffhanger, finish off in a short story to bridge it into a next book?
I don't know about necessarily having a story finish in a short story as much as the event is pretty self-contained. And I liked the idea that people could go and read the self-contained book, that it would make sense as part of the progression of the character, but you wouldn't have to read it for the other books to make sense. But I had a lot of fun writing it, and I tend to write long. I mean, I start a book, and my books are about 100,000 words, but when I started writing them, they were at 110, and I'd have to cut them down. So I naturally write long. So when they told me, 10,000 words, you have to have a full mystery and everything, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a fun challenge. But I loved doing it. So, yeah, I think the possibility of doing one again, definitely. I'm not sure when, because I am writing two series right now.
Right, yeah.
But hopefully.
You're also into a whole – because you're into another series that's much different than this one. And how is that dynamic, having to kind of jump roles back and forth?
You know, the benefit of it, my Lawman series is romantic suspense as compared to the Profiler books, which are straight psychological suspense. It's fun because I'm writing such different stories and such different characters that jumping back and forth from one to the other kind of refreshes me for each series. So I don't get, sort of tired of the series I'm writing, I guess, burned out on it, because as soon as I write one of that series, I'm jumping to the other series, and it kind of refreshes. Each one refreshes me for the other. So it's been a great thing to jump back and forth, actually. It's worked really well.
Mm-hmm. And how does it help you with your writing? I mean, how does it help you as an author? Does it give you different ideas to kind of jump back and forth? Are you able to use certain things in certain series that you're able to maybe do some crossover with the writing because it is different?
I am, actually. For the book that I just turned into my editor a week or two ago, for my Lawman series, I had Evelyn Bain from the Profiler series make a cameo, which is the first time I've done that, and that was really cool, because they're both set in the law enforcement world, but my Lawman books are shorter. They're only 60,000 words, and so the challenge of, I think, writing, getting that much plot and putting a love story into 60,000 words kind of taught me that I can fit more into a smaller space, and so I think that actually helped me write bigger books with the Profiler story too, because I realized, I can fit this much into 60,000 words. Well, think how much I can really put into 100,000 words. So I do think that the challenge of writing two different series with different genres has given me strengths that I've been able to cross over. For the first time, being able to pull one of my characters from the Profiler series into the Lawman books was a great experience. And hopefully readers who read both will spot her and be excited about that.
Now, would the same reader be the same reader for both series, or is it two separate types of readers that you're kind of writing about? Or that you're kind of writing for, not about, but for?
Right. There's definitely crossover. I have people who read all of them, both series, because the romantic suspense is still heavy on the suspense, but there's definitely a romance. So, I mean, those books are shelved in romance. And then my Profiler series are definitely suspense, and they're shelved in fiction, but they're mystery stories. So there is crossover, and then there's some people who don't want as dark of a suspense, and they like more romance, and so they just read my Lawman books. And there's some people who don't really want to see any romance in their mystery, and they like the darker, grittier books, and so they only read my Profiler stories. So I guess I have a bit of both.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like you try to differentiate yourself in both series, because then otherwise it's like, well, why are you writing two series that are like identical, just kind of put the characters together or whatever. So you do have that separation from the Lawman series to the Profiler series. But, yeah, I you can definitely see how there's the crossover. And which, I guess, challenging to write for you? Which series kind of, when you sit down and you do it, it kind of gives you the most problems, you know, maybe starting out in?
That's an interesting question. I guess there's challenges to both. The challenges of the Lawman books are just, I think, primarily the length, that in 60,000 words I have to fit in a really full plot and fit in a full story between two characters who fall in love. And then in my Profiler books, I have all this space. I have 100,000 words, and I the challenge is to make the story as twisty and turny as possible and get in all the psychological elements and still, at the end of the book, have someone say, you know, oh, I should have seen that. I should have realized, because all the clues were there along the way. So they both have challenges. They're different. I kind of feel like writing each one has made me better at writing the other in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they pull on different strengths, and
yeah,
they necessarily pull on different strengths. And so writing the Lawman books has taught me things about writing that I can apply to the Profiler books and vice versa.
And the other kind of thing is that, you know, writing two series, of course, it takes a lot of time. You know, I don't know if a lot of fans just think, oh, you can just sit down and, you know, peg out a book and get it all done. But, you know, you're talking, it takes a lot of time to kind of do this. Do you envision yourself going forward with two, or do you think maybe one might overtake the other in the future? Do you have any idea?
Right now I'm continuing forward with both. I have three more books in the Lawman series that are in progress, and I just turned in, I'm actually waiting for revisions on the fourth Profiler book. So I hope to continue both. It's a challenge, but I love writing both, so I hate to give up either one of them, to be honest. It is true that one refreshes me for the other, so I do really like bouncing back and forth between them.
And now, when you think of a plot line that you kind of want to roll, are you thinking of the plot line first, or are you thinking of the series and then what plot line you're going to kind of do without, or are you going to kind of put in there? Or do you say, okay, this is a great plot for the Lawman series, or this is a great plot for the Profiler series, or this is a great plot that I don't know is going to fit in either one of them, so maybe I'll file it away for a rainy day?
I've actually done all three of those things. Sometimes I start off and I'm thinking specifically of my Profiler and what would really fit for profiling and kind of where she is in her journey and what scenes I want to talk about. And so I know from the start that the plot I'm working on is going in the Profiler series. Sometimes I just have an idea for something and I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And then I start thinking about the two series and I realize which one it's going to fit in. And then I've definitely had the cases where I have an idea for a plot, but I know that the characters aren't right in either series for the plot, so I have a file of all these extra ideas. Because I do think that it's important that the character and plot really interact in a very strong way, and if you don't have the right character for a particular plot, it's not going to be as strong of a book. And so I have some plots, I think, that just don't really work well for either series, so I'm holding on to them.
And do you sit there, and when you do kind of have those ideas, Do you tweak it to make it fit within a certain series, or are you like, you know what, I'm not going to tweak it, I'll think of something else, and I'm going to use this later?
It depends. So I had an idea a long time ago for a story that I thought, like a plot line that I wanted to use, and I didn't think that it was going to work for my Profiler series. And actually, I didn't think it would work well for the Lawman series either. But when I was I wrote the first set, and it didn't really fit for any of those. And I thought I was just going to use it for some other book, some standalone down the line. And then when I started writing the second set of the Lawman books, I realized, you know, if I could use a part of this idea in a totally different way, and make it fit this plot for the Lawman series. And so I did end up doing that. And it turned into kind of a very different plot than what it had started out being, but the kernel, that first kernel of idea that got me excited about it was the same.
Mm-hmm. And is there a subject matter that you just won't touch?
Yeah, I think probably. I mean, I have dealt with, you know, child abduction and Vanished, which was a really tough topic. I think more than a subject, it's the how deep you go into a certain area of it. Like, I won't show, I have scenes from my serial killer's point of view in Hunted, and I have scenes from the child abductor's point of view in Vanished, but I don't ever show anything on the page that gets too gruesome with the victims, just because I don't like reading that. There's a place for it, and I read authors who do it really well, and it's very realistic. But to me, then you get too far away from entertainment, and I don't like, as a general rule, I don't like to read that. So I think less about the subject and more about how dark I'm going to go with what I show with what happens to some of the victims. And there's a line there that I won't cross.
Gotcha.
Because I think at a certain point it can become like not a great thing to show as far as real life victims. I mean, it's in some ways doing them a disservice to turn it into entertainment. I mean, in some ways
gotcha.
You can make it a learning thing, but I just don't want to put that in a book that I'm putting out there as an entertaining mystery. So I think it's less about the subject and more about the depth that I go into something.
Very well said. Now, we got about a minute left, and so I want to give you kind of the last word to be able to kind of let everybody know where they can find you, your social media, what you got coming up in the future, the whole nine yards. So I'm going to leave that up to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, you can find me on the website, as you mentioned. It's elizabethheiter.com. Heiter is H-E-I-T-E-R. The books are, you should be able to get them anywhere. You can get books online or Barnes & Noble, anything like that. And up next is the fourth book in the Profiler series. It's called Stalks. And it begins with a teenager walking into her high school. Her boyfriend drops her off, drives away. The cheerleading squad on the field watches her go inside. And then she never comes out again. And she shouldn't have been able to leave the high school without anybody seeing her, but she disappears. And a couple of months later, they find a note in her room that foretells her own death. And so Evelyn is called on to the case to figure out what really happened to her. So that book comes out at the end of this year. And then I'm working on three more books in my Lawman series that haven't been scheduled yet, but that'll be up on my website. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter as well. You can find all those links on my website, or it's just search for me with her, Elizabeth Heiter, online.
Do you go to any conferences?
I will be at the Romance Writers Conference this summer, and I will be at BoucherCon in the fall.
Oh, you're going to New Orleans?
Yes, I can't wait. I've never been there.
Well, I have a feeling that when the data that is, and I saw that, I was like, oh, it's going to be so flippin' hot in New Orleans at that time. So,
okay.
That's the only thing. It's like 11 o'clock at night. It's like 90 degrees, and you're like, oh, my God. So bring extra clothes because you're going to sweat through like four layers in like 2 days.
Well, that's good to know. I didn't realize that, actually.
Yes. Well, Elizabeth, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for coming back, and we wish you nothing but the best. So, of course, keep us up to date. Love to have you back on, you know, with the next book, and maybe a little closer to the release date, and we'll work all that out.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you for having me.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is Elizabeth Heiter, and you can check out her latest book called Seized. It is book 3 in the Profiler series. Came out at the same time, was a short story called Avenged. But go back and check out The Hunted and check out Vanished. And if you're into a little bit more romance with your suspense, she has a Lawman series going on that's also available. Go to Elizabeth Heiter, HEITER.com, for more information on all of her works. We want to thank David Putnam for coming on to the show also today. It's been great 60 minutes. We will be back here tomorrow with a one-on-one. We're going to have Anthony Frazee on. And then we're going to take Monday off Beyond the Cover. I'm on vacation. And then Crime and Science Radio will be on next Saturday. So until then, everybody, we want to say thank you so much. Keep on reading. Goodbye.